ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
How reliable is your memory of a crime scene? And can those memories be manipulated?
Connected to wrongful convictions?
How a memory works can be damaging for a justice system and for the integrity of a justice system.
This is Sana Qadar from All in the Mind. If you are a fan of true crime, you should check out our new series, Forensic. It's about the quirks and curiosities of our weird human brains. Search for All in the Mind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Treasurer is selling this week's budget as if it's an attempt to help young people locked out of home ownership.
I'd rather defend a shift in policy than leave a broken status quo in place to do more damage. Too many Australians, particularly young Australians, are locked out of the housing market, and that's what motivates us.
And it will help. But beneath the changes to capital gains tax, to income tax, and the taxation of trusts, lies a deeper shift. One whose outlines are only now becoming apparent, days after the budget. The shift is to treat people who make money from work differently to people who make money, from bank interest, from financial instruments, those sorts of things. And there's a lot more in the budget besides. We're about to hear from a former Victorian Treasury official, a former New South Wales Treasury official, and a former Commonwealth Treasury official, all three of whom described the changes as uncommonly bold, perhaps the boldest this century, the boldest in a generation. Welcome to The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and our guests, former Victorian Treasury and Commonwealth Treasury official Amy Oster, who now runs Policy Institute Australia, former New South Wales Treasury official, she's done a lot more besides, Arina Sathanapalli, who now runs the Grattan Institute, and former Commonwealth Treasury economist Tom Crowley, who's now the ABC's economics reporter in Parliament House. Welcome Amy, Arina and Tom.
Thank you, Peter. Good to be here.
Great to be here, Peter.
Lovely to be here.
Tom, in that post-budget speech, the one we just heard a bit of, Treasurer Jim Chalmers used the words generational or generations or intergenerational 12 times, once every 2 minutes. Is that the right frame? Is that the best way of looking at this divide, or is there another one?
Look, I think it's one of two, and the other one also begins with the same three letters, and that is generosity. And that was the main word when Labor last visited these tax concessions back in 2019. I actually went back to have a look at that 2019 election when Jim Chalmers was the shadow finance minister. And it was like stepping into a time vortex. He was talking about the top end of town. These are tax breaks for, you know, essentially the 1%. And in the lead up to this budget, that was not at all what he was saying. It was all about intergenerational housing. And questions were beginning to be asked from some people who knew where this might be going to say, well, if you're going to grandfather, are you going to necessarily do all that much on the intergenerational front? And so I thought it was interesting to see how much the budget, yes, as you say, is built around this housing narrative, but also really took a step back into this narrative, framing these tax concessions as unfair because the benefits of them go overwhelmingly to those at the very top of the income scale. Some new analysis from the Commonwealth Treasury on that front that I thought was really interesting in the budget papers, and perhaps we can get into it. The first picture that I have ever seen of the lifetime income distribution of the benefits of these tax concessions, all three together, the capital gains tax discount, negative gearing and discretionary trusts, and the 1%, a skyscraper next to everybody else on a bar graph that I'm audio describing. Really interesting analysis there, and a full-throated argument that the government is making alongside its generational argument about fairness. Contentious territory for them to be in, but that's where we now find ourselves.
Are they moving away from treating income from wages the same as income from, you name it, capital gains, trusts, whatever?
I think that is where they will continue to head, yes. And that's the other key part of this budget, which is the WATO. I don't know that anyone's quite worked out how to
Working
pronounce it
Australians
yet.
Australians Tax Offset.
That's the one.
The
and
new
we
acronym.
Better get used to it because it's $250 a year now, small to begin with.
It works out at more than that. If you consider it as an increase to the tax-free threshold, it works out at $1,800. It adds to your tax-free threshold and, I guess, moves it up nearer to $20,000, but only if you are a worker. If you are someone who gets your money from trusts, someone who gets your money from capital gains, you'll pay 30% minimum instantly from the first dollar. No tax-free threshold for you. This is a big change. Aaron, might this be the start of a dual-track income tax system, the kind that was discussed at the Productivity Roundtable, the one you took part in last year, where we don't treat income as income. We treat it differently if it comes from work and differently if it comes from, how can I put this, I'm not wishing to be pejorative, unearned income.
Yeah, so I think this is one of the features of our tax system, our personal income tax system, as we muddle it all together. And we have a single set of progressive tax scales that apply to income no matter how you get it. But then we have a series of different concessions for different types of instruments. And then until this budget, some clever ways to get out of it, depending on how you structured your tax affairs, particularly income splitting. Now, when I spoke to the Reform Roundtable last year, you know, it kind of went through how our personal income tax system stacks up compared to other countries. One of the things that we don't do is split out how we tax labour income versus how we tax non-labour income. Talking about labour income first, labour income is available to everybody, right? It is the thing you can do no matter what you start with in life, no matter who your parents are. But also labour income is generally not particularly mobile. So you work where you work and you can apply a progressive scale to labour income in a way that is harder for what you can call capital income. Capital is typically a bit more mobile. And so there are reasons to tax those two things differently, and they go in different directions. There are arguments you would make to tax labour more lightly because of this sense that it's available to everybody. But equally, there's arguments you might make to tax capital more lightly because it's more mobile, and so you're more worried about it going elsewhere.
It'd be different. Whatever you did, it wouldn't necessarily be the same.
That's exactly right. And I think that the case for a progressive tax system applies with labour income. When you come to non-labour income, that's when you're typically trying to create the least distortion possible. You want a simple system that is hard to avoid through structuring, a flat rate applies to everything that enables people to then put their money in the place that most makes sense for them, most makes sense for their appetite for risk, for the reward they're seeking, rather than having a system, which is effectively the system we've had, where particular forms of investment make sense for tax reasons rather than for their fundamentals. And in particular, you can time your investment actions or the things you do with your money to minimise your tax burden rather than timing them in a way that would otherwise make sense for you.
And the budget papers talked about this. They said people time their capital gains to when they're on a very low tax rate or a zero tax rate to begin with because they've retired and they get the first $18,000 or so tax-free, which is frankly outrageous. It merely is a matter of timing when you'd expect their capital gains to be taxed. Amy, is that sort of rebalancing needed to treat wage income differently, not necessarily higher or lower, but differently to income from money?
I think the rebalancing is needed. And I want to start off by saying I think the government really is to be congratulated and commended for tackling these sacred cows. I mean, you know, tax reform is sort of the third rail, and this is really...
For non-Americans, can you tell us, and I think we'd like to know, what is the third rail?
Like the electrified rail, you know?
Explain what the US rail system is like.
Well... To be honest, I'm not sure I know the details of that. I'm an economist, not an engineer, but I know you don't go near it because it's electrified.
It's the middle track, isn't it? So you've got two tracks, one for one wheel, one for the other. In the middle is an electrified track that provides the power to the trains. Do not touch it.
Don't touch it. It's electrified.
So they're doing that. They're beginning to touch what we had thought was the third rail.
And it's critically important. You were talking about how this has been pitched as intergenerational equity, that it's about wealth. I think for me, when I look at it, this is about two things. People who are able to accumulate wealth in housing, because when we look at that chart, in the budget papers that is primarily about housing. It's not surprising that people who are older accumulate more wealth. That is what will generally naturally occur over a lifetime. But of course, that's not only older people, because as we know, single older women are the fastest growing cohort of homelessness. So it is generally true, but it is not specifically true. I think what's really important about this tax reform and what was talked about a lot in the tax forum that was the precursor to the economic roundtable is the issue that we're having on our income tax progressivity, meaning that you have not insignificant proportion of people who are in the very upper tax brackets who pay an effective tax rate that's the same as somebody who earns half the income they do. And that is because of the access to these kinds of tax breaks. So it's moving against what really should be a much more, and what we intend to be, a progressive income tax system. And that's where the inequity comes in, I think.
Tom, might an end game of this be that tax-free threshold we've got, $18,000, a bit more than that? You can understand how that's a good thing for someone going back into the workforce or a child starting work. It's perhaps unreasonable for them to pay tax on the first dollars they earn. I don't think anyone would say that it's reasonable for someone making a capital gain to pay no tax on the first dollars they earn. Might the end result of this be that it's called the Working Australians Tax Offset, you know, the benefit in terms of the tax-free threshold is $1,800 to start with, that ultimately this becomes the tax-free threshold. That is, that workers get their first $20,000 tax-free, but not anyone who makes money in any other way. Has the Treasurer, he seems to be hinting that he wouldn't be adverse to moving in that direction.
I think it's probably a few steps ahead, but yes, he absolutely has said that he plans to build on this in some way. I think in the short term, that's more likely to be just a bigger version of the offset roughly as it looks now. I think, you know, maybe it's Treasury's master plan that eventually you might be able to use this to kind of build, in a sense, brick by brick, a dual income tax system where whether you replace the tax-free threshold with a version of the same thing on something that looks like a wages tax schedule and then have what might be closer to it, just a flat tax on investment, and maybe the number 30 is the magic number that is starting to appear. I think we'd be getting too far ahead of ourselves if we thought that that was where Labor was going to go immediately. I think that the idea of replacing the tax-free threshold would be a difficult thing intuitively for people of the Labor fold to wrap their heads around, perhaps. But I do think that, bringing it back for a moment to the politics, that the distinction between active and passive income, to put it that way, is one that I think Labor feels that it is onto a winner with. But also, people from the Liberal side of politics who I've spoken to this week, who've been very deflated of late for reasons we can all understand, feel that they have something interesting to say now about the economy as well, and that this has given something that they can react to, because there are a lot of young people, you know, we don't know how big the group is, you know, thinking about themselves as share market players. There are apps now that allow people with relatively low means to just sort of pick and choose shares, and people who look at ETFs and that sort of thing more than they might have in the past, who feel like they're being talked about when you draw this distinction between active and passive income. So it's an interesting political terrain.
I mean, look, can I come in on this? Not from the politics perspective, but maybe, you know, as the sort of Treasury master plan perspective. As our population gets older and as the proportion of people who are working for a wage shrinks, I do think you have to think a bit more actively about a tax system that's resilient to that change, and think particularly hard about how you preserve those work incentives for labour and how you realistically raise the money you need for services when a greater share of your population are earning their income in a passive income sense. And so I can see why, you know, from a Treasury perspective, if you're thinking not for the next 10 years, but you're thinking 20 or 30 years ahead, you want a system that's going to be resilient to that shift in your working age population.
I should point out that if you're interested in what the changes to negative gearing and capital gains tax will do to housing, who gets to own homes, who gets to rent, what homes and rents cost, we've just done a whole podcast about that, a special emergency edition of The Economy Stupid, in conjunction with ABC Radio's By Design. We put the two shows together. It's now on your podcast feed. There's an awful lot more in this year's budget, and an awful lot by the usual standards, and we're about to discuss whether what's in the overstuffed tin will do what it says on the tin, here on The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin. A guest this week, three former Treasury officials, New South Wales, Commonwealth and Victoria, Arunah Sathnapalli, Tom Crowley and Amy Oster. Arunah, just one of the 15 measures in the productivity package in the budget is reforming the permanent migration points test to better select higher skilled migrants. That's a massive program all by itself. All of those budget watchers, people who've been chanting forever, productivity measures, do something to improve productivity. Have they got what they wanted? There's an awful lot here.
There is an awful lot here. And I think that that's, you know, maybe what didn't get enough attention on budget night. Fair enough. It's not as sexy as some of the, you know, the big tax stuff. But
lifting productivity isn't sexy. It is a lot of small individual things, which hopefully work when they're added together.
That's right. Look, that's the position we're in today, that there's a whole lot of, I think there's this lovely metaphor that, like, you know, a cricket metaphor, that we're in a world of lots of ones and twos rather than big sixes. Those big sixes might come, but they'll come from technology, they'll come from developments through innovation. But what government can do is all of those ones and twos, or working on those things that are a drag on our ability to get the most out of our human capital, the most out of our infrastructure. And so there are a couple of, like, wonderful kernels in the budget. Obviously, there's going to be work that needs to be done off the back of this to actually make the reforms stick. But the one you mentioned, Grattan did a big piece of work 2 years ago on the points test. And we went away and we looked at all of the data on how people who move to Australia fare over their lifetimes in order to understand what it is that our points test system ought to be doing when it's trying to select the most skilled applicants. Now, we don't have enough spots for all of the people who would like to move to Australia, so we need to put in place the best test that we can to be able to select people, but also be able to select them in a way that doesn't necessarily have them jumping through unnecessary hoops. The system we have at the moment sets up a whole lot of hoops and criteria, and what we found is that most of those don't actually correlate to what creates success in Australia. And so what we recommended was that the system be simplified down to the key things that matter, being education level, English language and skilled work experience, and that for people who meet those things with the highest amount of points, that they should be guaranteed a visa. And what we should get rid of is, you know, lists of skills shortages that basically get people doing certain sorts of jobs or certain sorts of training courses in order to get points on the points test, because those things don't actually stack up in terms of what gets the best outcomes.
So this is one good thing. What's your favourite, Amy, from a packed menu of things?
Can I have a few? It's very hard to pick one. So I love the making free access to standards from Standards Australia.
Isn't this amazing? We charge builders $1,600 to be able to read the building standards that they're required to abide by.
Yeah, it's insane. I mean, you can understand why over a period of time that happened, and, you know, but you look at the end result and you say, that makes no sense at all. The second one that I was just so happy to see mentioned in the budget papers was streamlining administration of the payroll tax, because from a business perspective, this is absolutely the most costly tax to comply with.
Each state does it, and yet most businesses are across more than one state.
But it's not just that. Payroll tax does not have prefill. It's basically not digitized. So, you know, now if you're paying your own income tax, the ATO sends this thing in every year and says, this is what you think we owe because of this. And you look through it and you go, oh, I need to adjust here and there. Whereas for a business, you're doing it from scratch every single time. It is a tremendous time suck in terms of compliance. So I love that it was mentioned. But the challenge is, how do you actually get that done? Policy and implementation almost works like a neural pathway. It's got channels that flow. And if you want to change the dynamic, it's a lot of work. So it's mentioned there's some funding for this kind of really important deregulatory work, improved regulatory compliance practices, but how are we going to actually make that happen? We need some of the structural change in how we implement policy to do that.
Might it also be, Tom, that the Commonwealth itself isn't very good at things? So by trying to do everything everywhere all at once, I mean, look at the cases where the Commonwealth has actually tried to do things. Pink bats, defence procurement, things like that. The skills aren't necessarily there. And lots of these measures, the huge suite of measures in the budget, actually require careful implementation.
They do. I mean, I think the implementation is one thing. The dealing with these kind of, you know, intransigent stakeholders and the different interests that are at play here is the other. And that's where I'm particularly just interested to see how the one that I, it was my favourite on the list that Aaron mentioned before, the migration points test is a good example of something that's going to be really hard to see through, both the points test and the commitment to reduce the time it takes for migrants to have their qualifications recognised so that they can work here, both things that Martin Parkinson has been talking about for a long time, really hard to get right. I mean, the occupational licensing question, you've got to go through occupation by occupation, professional bodies, unions with their own thoughts to bear in every single different occupation, making a case for total exceptionalism. You know, it's almost like the occupational equivalent of NIMBYism, not in my profession, that, oh, yes, you know, we're all in favour of the skills recognition, but in our particular profession, there's this thing you've got to think about, and only this sort of person who's gone through this Australian accreditation process can possibly expect to have their skills recognised. And you know, you can make a commitment to resolve that, but the amount of political will it takes to get through it is really difficult. And I think on the skills front specifically, Labor had a pretty good crack at that in the last term, doing a lot of that unglamorous work of tripartite consultation, as they call it, getting businesses and unions in the room together, trying to figure out where those competing tensions were, ended up in the long grass. And I worry that the same could happen here again, because as soon as it gets really controversial and maybe away from headline news, it can be really easy to just sort of let something die quietly. So that will be the challenge, not just on the productivity dimension of this budget, but on so many of them. I think the NDIS is a whole other topic that we could talk about there as well, where the implementation will matter.
Perhaps we should. You're giving the impression that the Treasurer is biting off a lot of things, all of the right things. The question now is whether the government can chew. Amy, while doing this, the government's under all sorts of pressure to restrain spending from the Reserve Bank, among other stakeholders, to take pressure off inflation. And the NDIS would be a big part of that. How's the government doing on that?
Tackling the NDIS is huge. And maybe it's overdue, but it is a very, very difficult path. And I think, you know, there's a round of applause there that this process is now underway. A couple of other things really stood out to me. One was the evident cap on APS, on the size of the public service, so much so that the Mandarin actually called this government the Razor Gang, which sort of made me have a giggle. But, you know, this is a government that came into office talking about restoring the public service. There's been a lot of hiring. We've now come to the end of that process. And I think the finance minister has been very clear about that. That's an important part. And the third thing is the way that the cost of living relief was structured and framed. It is much more targeted at lower income households than previous cost of relief offerings have been. And it's much more specific to areas that are really hurting. So it is not the, if you like, cash splash approach that we've seen.
Yeah, in the past, you got it if you used electricity. The more electricity you use, the bigger your house, the more benefit you got. You've
exactly
got it
right.
If you use petrol. The more petrol, diesel your car used, the more you got. You would give it marks both for discipline and ambition, but I suppose, as Tom was just saying, it's in the doing.
Of course. Of course, it is in the doing, and you know, and there's a lot of work to be done, and you know, and you look at the aggregates and you say, okay, well, expenditure as a share of GDP is still about 1 percentage point higher over the forwards than it was in the pre-COVID, in the coalition's last pre-COVID budget, and it would be nice if we could get back there, you know, and in an environment where we're still fighting inflation, that would maybe help. nonetheless, I think a lot of effort has been put in on the expenditure side.
And just to be clear, Peter, I mean, I don't point to the kind of the daunting scale of the ambition as a reason not to, rather than just an exhortation that the implementation part is important and keep going. And I think to return to Aaron's cricket metaphor, it's about, you know, at this stage of the test match, maybe that the ones and twos need to, you need to accumulate, build a partnership, start to make a difference on the scoreboard and keep going at this rather than just the announcement. And I think that Amy's points are excellent.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things about spending, we did a bit of analysis just to have a look at that, you know, that overall growth in spending. And it is driven by two things. It is driven by the NDIS and it is driven by aged care. So of course you need spending discipline across the board, but if you're really concerned about the so-called size of government, those are the two things you need to look at. One of those, I think the NDIS, they've gone and set out the really tough decisions. There are probably some more tough decisions down the track on aged care and hospitals. Now, either we make some really tough decisions there in terms of lowering service standards, or we grapple with the fact that it is just more expensive to be an older, richer country. And that's where the tax side comes in. So I think that there's things you can do in spending, but really the NDIS and aged care are where you can make a big difference.
Aruna, Amy, Tom, thank you. Before we go, as is traditional, anything to look out for in the days and weeks ahead? Amy.
Well, can I be a little bit tongue-in-cheek and say I live in Melbourne, so I'm really watching this weekend to see if Carlton gets a departure of Coach Bounce.
This is a sporting program.
But beyond that, and one thing that another element of the budget that I think hasn't gotten probably nearly the attention it deserves is what's happening on the defense side. And this week, of course, President Trump is meeting Xi Jinping, and I guess we'll see if he gets his hug.
Aruna.
Oh, look, I mean, we're going to put out some work towards the back end of this month on energy and on gas. This budget was quite quiet on some of that stuff, you know, maybe deflating a few expectations, particularly on gas tax. So we're going to be doing some work on that and putting out a few things about how Australia's system needs to adapt to a smaller role for gas in the future.
You look like the cat with the cream on budget night, because the Grattan agenda, which was doing things about capital gains tax, doing things about trust, taking a look at negative gearing. I suppose it's a good reason not to give up.
No, well, I mean, no, not quite the cat with the cream. I think I'd echo Amy's point. Like, it has been so long since, you know, we've gotten into the box of tax reform. Now, I am absolutely ready to debate the fine details, and we might not have those 100% correct, and I think all of the experts will be happy to have that conversation. At least we're having the conversation. It's not some abstract hypothetical conversation. If the government would ever do tax reform, we could maybe talk about whether inflation indexing is better than X, Y, or Z. We're actually getting to do it. So yeah, I think that was excitement shared across many people who I share Amy's view. Tax is a tremendously important part of the fundamentals of structuring our society and our economy, and we've ruled it out for too long.
What are you looking out for, Tom?
Well, I'm also looking forward to some football, some sunshine, just anything that's not being in this awful windowless building that is Parliament House at the end of this week. But one more event to get through first, and that is the budget reply speech tonight from Angus Taylor. And to pick up on Aaron's note, I think tax indexation, bracket creep might be a theme tonight and give us even more to talk about on the tax reform front. So I'm looking forward to seeing exactly what that will look like. It's a throw everything at the wall and see what sticks approach from the opposition leader coming this evening.
Tom Crowley will be watching it in Parliament House, where he's the ABC's economics reporter. Aruna Sathanapelli is the head of the Grattan Institute. Amy Oster is the head of Policy Institute Australia. Thank you so much for today's post-budget program.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Peter.
And thank you for listening. You can find our episodes on the ABC Listen app or on ABC Radio National Thursdays. If you have any thoughts or questions or comments, no economic question is stupid, you can email us via theeconomy.stupid@abc.net.au. Thanks to producer Sam Carmody. Happy Budget Week. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.